Welcome to Grub and Grace. I am Mark Flower, and today we have Joe Smith with us as we get into current events such as the death of the Pope Francis and deportations, as well as talking about Christian nationalism and what it looks like to bring heaven to earth. There's enough room at the table, so stay and partake in the conversation with us, for Shift Happens with Joe Smith. Welcome back to Grub and Grace. I'm your host, Mark Flower. I am here with Joe Smith. Thanks for being on the show.
Yeah, man. I appreciate you reaching out. I often am on the other side of this, so it's fun being the interviewee rather than the interviewer. So yeah, it'll be fun. Appreciate it.
Yeah. And I just listened to your episode with Dr. Jonathan Foster.
Yeah.
I got a chance to meet him at Theology Beer Camp last fall and talked to him.
Oh, did you really?
Yeah, we talked about Sauron and the beginnings of Sauron and how he wasn't initially bad in the beginning. And he was almost like a fallen angel, almost in a way that he was kind of, in a way, groomed by Morgoth, I think it was. And so I was like, you know, I do an episode talking about this. And he's like, I don't know if we can do a full episode. Maybe we can do like a partial episode.
He's such a nice guy. I found his book not early on, but probably in a really crucial stage of my deconstruction, his book, The Theology of Consent. And it just made a big impact. And he was super gracious to come on and talk. So that's awesome.
Yeah. And I noticed you also had some conversations with April Joy promoting her book and everything. Mm-hmm. I actually went to school with April briefly, got a chance to meet her a little bit. And I actually saw her back at Theology Beer Camp as well. So we haven't really kept in touch too much, but every so often our paths cross. So
it's such a small world.
Such a small world.
Yeah.
So there is a lot that's happening in the world today, and lots of craziness, lots of just happening. Most recently, of course, Easter just happened and the Pope has just passed away. There's been a lot of news revolving around that. And of course, depending on the news that you listen to, you get different takes. You get lots of memes of how the Pope died because he didn't want to talk to J.D. Vance anymore. I mean, you get a lot of this, stuff around that. Do you have any thoughts on Pope dying and like the life that he lived?
Well, you know, not being Catholic, not coming from Catholicism at all, I think the Pope, particularly this Pope, Pope Francis, was a little bit more nuanced and complicated than previous popes. And again, this is to my limited understanding, but, you know, for all of the, you know, complications with this Pope, I think it's a lot of both and. Like, there are things that I wish that he would have pushed further. And yet at the same time, you know, he pushed that institution probably further than it's ever been. So while not getting to the place that I feel like churches should be at, you know, whether it's, you know, theological or, you know, just with things like inclusion, a more holistic way of seeing, you know, Christianity and the world, I do think that part of his legacy that hopefully whoever comes next will carry forward and continue to push will be those things of, like, you know, liberation, where the Pope centered the poor, centered, you know, the outcast, where I just read yesterday where, and I didn't know this, where, like, I think 2 days after the response of the of Israel towards the Gaza Strip, I think early on, don't quote me on this. I mean, I know it's a podcast, but I think it was just 2 days after that initial retaliation, and, you know, where Israel just kept on. He called like every night and called into one of the churches there in Gaza, just to keep that light, just to let them know they weren't forgotten. Mm-hmm. So I think it's those things that we can, you know, kind of tap into, resonate, and hopefully will kind of be guideposts for whoever's next.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of April Joy, she reposted something, I think yesterday or something, about the Pope. And it was him talking about the inclusiveness and lack of inclusiveness within the church. And the Pope was addressing a question about trans kids within the church and the lack of inclusion, the lack of acceptance within the church. And the Pope basically says that the church has, or the certain religious leaders that have infiltrated the church and use it for their own power and control and wealth and everything else that comes with that. I thought that was kind of a powerful little message, little thing that he said that really kind of showcases some of the character that he had. And like you said, there's a lot of complications. There's some things that you wish you would have done better, but I think there are a lot of things that he did really well. Mm-hmm. And I know a lot of that is being demonized right now by mostly on the right side, the right political leaning people, and not just people, but I'd say more of the voices, the influencers, mm-hmm. the politicians that are, you know, pushing these sort of ideas. So,
I think, yes. And I think the reason for that is because, again, it's both and, right? Where you've got this global leader at the top of this very patriarchal hierarchy, right? Who's advocating for change and for decentering some of the things that the Catholic Church has been known for. And not even the Catholic Church, but just more conservative, fundamentalist ways of seeing Christianity. And I think the pushback that you're seeing is not necessarily because of the Pope in and of himself, but because of what the Pope represented in a lot of those frameworks of, you know, where, you know, he washed the feet, kissed the feet of like prisoners and people of other religions. That decenters, that moves power away from the center and puts it back outside to the margins. And, you know, you've got your Charlie Kirks and you've got your, you know, your Mark Driscolls and some of the other ones, what's her name?
Allie Beth Stuckey.
Yes, that's it. Thank you. You know, you've got some of these talking heads, who rely on that power structure staying right where it's at. They have a vested interest in keeping things where it's at, mm-hmm. where I think what you're seeing is it has been called deconstruction. I think it's evolving. I think it's people moving out of whatever stage of human consciousness that they have been in towards something that is better. And I think that you're seeing, I think that's the juxtaposition that you're seeing right now, is that I think the Pope, for all of his misgivings, was trying to pull the Catholic Church in a direction and, you know, much of the church world with it. And then the pushback of these people that are like, yeah, but I make my money over here. I mm-hmm. find my power here. I find my belonging here. And anything that threatens that is dangerous or evil or whatever.
Mm-hmm. So I listen to Trip Fuller every so often, and on one of his episodes on one of his podcasts that he has, he was kind of talking about, they're referring to Bonhoeffer, and they were talking about Bonhoeffer, but he says this. So we know that religion functions in human society as a kind of dynamic, as a kind of system that takes humanly constructed things and raises them to a level of transcendent authority, which gives people the sort of authority to say, I'm not doing this. God wants this. Religion creates the imperial Christ. Religion creates the domination systems. Religion creates the categories of sacred and secular and religious and non-religious in order to kind of wall us off from the systems of power that seek power and influence in the world. What I wonder going forward is how we can speak to those Christians who are literally our brothers and sisters who have been captured by an alien ideology. The Christian that they've put at the center of their world is not the Christ that Bonhoeffer puts at the center of his. I thought that was so powerful. Like when I was listening, I was like, I got to write this down. This is like something I want to remember, because I just love how he put that. It was so eloquent and beautiful and kind of encapsulates this whole misconstrued Christianity in America right now.
Yeah, I resonate with that so deeply. One of the things that we've been talking about here just locally in our faith community is how do we speak to those people that are still in places that we've come from, and, you know, kind of trying to put yourself back into those places. How do you build bridges? And I just recently had a conversation with Dr. Mish Van Essen, where she's working on something that she labels foundationalism, where you can take, let's just take the word love, right? And when I say love, that does not include things like eternal conscious torment, right? It's, to me, it's unfathomable that you could encapsulate that idea within the framework of love. Coming from where I came from, it was easily in the word love, right? Mm-hmm. So like when I say the word love and I'm having a conversation with somebody that may be more, one of my more conservative friends, and he says the word love, we're talking about fundamentally two different things and we're talking right past each other. And so I was trying to figure out, okay, well, how do I communicate to a person that's, that still sees things, you know, very literal, holds the Bible as like the ultimate authority, that kind of, and I don't mean this in a mean or negative way, but just that circular reasoning of the Bible is true because it says so, right? Mm-hmm. And how do I reach back and talk to those people? I have yet to totally figure it out. So if anybody listening knows, I'd shoot me an email because I'd love to figure it out.
I saw it was like of some sort of video, someone was talking about just this, and the person responded, you know, basically hear them out and ask them a question. I know you feel very passionate about this. I can sense that. Tell me why this impacts you deeply, and allow them to speak into that. Allow them to try to process it through their words, explaining how that does impact them. And then you can maybe, you know, jump in and respond after that. But instead of, you know, hearing them out and then initially saying like, no, like, you know, this is why I believe this is wrong, like allow them to process that. And that's what I heard from a lot of, I think it was, what was his name? Dr. Stephen Hassan, who is a cult expert on social media, states that when communicating with those engulfed in a cult, you have to communicate in ways that will allow them to think critically and allow them to come up with conclusions in their own time. Otherwise, they will just entrench themselves deeper in. So lately, I've been struggling with this too. And, you know, most of these people that I talk to might not be in the cult per se. Mm-hmm. But, you know, reflecting on Hassan's approach, how can I use this information to adequately communicate with just anybody that I come across? You know, I was talking with family recently and it was really difficult. My memory recall is really poor and I need notes. So you can see me looking back at my notes while I'm talking to you. And, you know, I'm trying to remember like facts or definitions or stuff like that as I'm talking to them. And I'm kind of struggling and they're not really getting exactly what I'm saying, because I'm talking in generals and general non-specifics, and they're like, well, tell me about this more, because it's not very convincing what you're doing. And yeah, it's one of those things that I'm constantly struggling, but I have to allow them to think critically. So what I did was I stopped and I you know, processed, and I said, you know, tell me more about, you know, why this is important to you. Tell me more about why you think this is. Tell me more about what you're bothered about this. And I let them talk and then I could respond after that. So I've been finding that, and I've been finding some success, some failure, but I'm still working all that out. So.
Yeah, I feel that. I've got a friend who is full on dyed in the wool MAGA, and wouldn't call himself this, but is a Christian nationalist. And we've been friends for, 2012, 2013. He was part of a church that I came down to Florida to help pastor that long ago. And he was an older guy, and I felt like he was one of those people that, you know, you kind of need to build some relationship with. So started meeting him for breakfast and have been meeting him for breakfasts ever since. We've had some of those conversations where I'll point out, you know, inconsistencies or some of the dissonance. And the difficulty that I have found is that and it may just be like, I'm not taking like him and making him to be everybody, but he falls back into, well, I feel, well, I think, you know, a lot. And so just trying to kind of chip away at that. And it's all about belonging, right? It's all about ego and belonging. And when those things are challenged, you're not only challenging just something that's, you know, factual or unfactual, but you're challenging, you know, his stance in a group. You're challenging the group. You're challenging God, you know, all of those things too. It can be very, very difficult. But because, you know, I say this all the time, but because I am, you know, white, straight, male, cis, all those things, Christian, I can walk into that conversation and walk out totally unscathed, because, I mean, there's nothing he can say to me, right? Like there's no threat in any conversation I have toward who I am. So, so that's why I keep walking back into it, because I can't lose sight of his humanity in the middle of all of this. And not everybody can do that, right? Not everybody can can walk into that, and nor should everybody. Mm-hmm. But because I am who I am, I can do that. But it is so difficult. I mean, it's just, it's so difficult.
Yeah. And I said this in a previous episode to a friend. Well, I'm still editing the episode. I haven't released it yet, but by the time this one comes out, it will be out. But I said that we have no, or basically people in the trans community have no obligation to, you know, meet with the oppressors. Same thing with people in the gay community, people in, you know, women don't need to, they have no obligation to meet with their abusers. Other marginalized people don't have any obligation to fight that fight. And that's where we, as, you know, straight white cis hetero male people, need to step up in their place to fight the battle that they don't need to do, that they've been victims of for so long. And I think it's so, you know, great that you're willing to do that, that hard work, and actually step up and do that. Because, you know, we need more people like you to be able to, you know, do those hard things that other people should not have to do.
Well, that's super kind of you. Thank you. Yes, to everything you said. I have, in my journey, I have been gracious enough to be blessed with some friendships and relationships of people from some of those communities that were willing to step in and, you know, be a bridge builder for me. I think mostly because we had relationship, and they knew who I was and knew, you know, that I was, you know, honestly trying to learn. But like you said, it's not their job. It was my job to do the work. They were just gracious enough to help be guides sometimes on that work, which is why I don't care too much for social media. I think a lot of it is just fake. It's a lot of noise. It was helpful. Some of that noise, I don't mean this in a negative way at all, because sometimes noise is really healthy, right? Sometimes the rage is healthy. I needed rage for a season, and then it was no longer helpful because I had kind of, like, you know, moved past that stage. So that was one of the reasons, like, for the things that you probably saw, which is how we connected, right? Which is the good part of social media, like being able to connect and do stuff like this. That's awesome. But what I found was, like, I didn't see a ton of people out there coming from the places that I had come from and speaking to the things that, like, just were driving me bananas, but not in a way that added to the anger or added to the rage or added to the noise, but tried to take maybe a less emotional, I don't even know if that's the right word, just a more measured approach, maybe, and just trying to, like, speak to the things that are happening and, like, okay, this is happening, but here's why. Like, here's, okay, this thing over here, RFK Jr. saying this crap, this insanity about autism, and now they're creating this, you know, registry. Well, what's the root of that, right? Like, well, that's rooted in white Christian nationalism, it's rooted in eugenics, it's rooted in all this bad stuff. So let's take a step back, take a breath, and, like, okay, well, what can we do about it? You know, so I felt like if I can participate in that, and being part of the solution in any kind of way, then I want to do that. And whether that's, like, you know, engaging with, you know, LGBTQ people, the trans community, our black and brown siblings, immigration, you know. But for me, my lane is where it intersects with Christianity. So, yeah, I do the work, do all the work.
Yeah, definitely. I love that you talked about, let's get to the root. Like, what's the cause of all this? I've been really finding an interest in just history, you know, finding out past things and how that relates to the world today. I think there's one guy on, again, social media, like you're talking about, there's good things and bad things, but there's the history wizard, I think is what he goes by. And he talks about how the bourgeoisie is kind of has always been the root cause of a lot of things, that a lot of bad things that have led up to now. You know, you get, like, the immigration laws of, like, the 1882 Chinese Exclusion Act, which put a 10-year ban on immigration and Chinese laborers, and there was a lot of things that, you know, came from that were harmful. And then you get, like, you know, the 1903 Immigration Act, also known as the Anarchist Expulsion Act, and then, you know, there's a lot of things that come with that. And it's just like learning the history and understanding like where a lot of this stuff actually came from to bring about policies today and why we haven't changed them either. I mean, there's a lot of people speaking out against, a lot of injustices. And I think, as a democracy, we've made a lot of strides and whatnot, which are being rolled back nowadays in a lot of ways. But there's still so much more to be done. And it's like, mm-hmm. we need to instruct people and teach them and allow people to figure out history on their own and find that need or want to be able to do that so that we can all learn and grow together.
It's so interesting you say that too, because I find that we're in this position where in a time in history where, the teaching of history is being outlawed, like here in the state of Florida, years ago. I mean, we've been fighting this for a while, and not that other places haven't, but we've been fighting this for a while. And, there are school districts where you cannot teach Ruby Bridges. The book on her life has been banned in several school districts. Mm-hmm. And it's so funny because I had a meeting yesterday. He's a professor at the University of Florida, which is where we live. And he teaches this in relation to politics and everything that's going on. He's walking a tightrope. He fully expects that he's going to lose his job by the end of this upcoming school year, because just the subject he teaches is going to go against some of the anti, diversity, equity, inclusion, or, it's going to be labeled woke, which is a big deal down here with our dear leader, Ronnie. But one of the things that he was talking about yesterday was you can see in the Deep South and the Jim Crow South in our history where there were times where teachers or Sunday school teachers were, accused of things, and like people would rally around them because they were stepping in that gap of, teaching things. And they were helping the community with like learning how to read, learning how to write. They did, and the Klan or whoever didn't want people educated so that they could continue to take advantage of them. So our conversation centered around, well, how can the church be part of that again? And one of the things that we started talking about was, well, what if the church taught the banned parts of history? What if instead of like a Sunday school class or small group, it taught Ruby Bridges? It taught these things that our kids or adults, right? Even adults weren't taught in school or not going to be taught in school, so that they could see the pattern, so that they could see, oh, wait, these things are rooted in history, and they may not be completely repeating themselves, but history rhymes. So when, you brought up Bonhoeffer, right? Well, where did the Nazis get their laws from? The Jim Crow South, right? Mm-hmm. They got it from America. Where did Bonhoeffer get his resistance? From the Black Church in the United States. Mm-hmm. Well, people don't know that. So how do we get them to – so that's one of the conversations for us here locally is, okay, well, how do we take this blueprint of resistance that has been laid out for us? It's already been lived out by the Black Church for centuries, by the Black community for centuries, and how do we apply it to the here and now? And yeah, I love what you said, and I think that's a key to moving forward. I don't know that everybody's going to jump on board or come to something like that or join a Zoom like that, but I think there are enough people that even if they don't see things the way I do theologically, right, that we can at least hold hands around other things and maybe we can build some bridges there. And I think it does start with like learning, knowing our history, learning those things, those root causes.
Well, speaking of history, and you're talking about us as churches, that we need to start doing what the schools aren't allowed to do now or are being pushed out. And I don't know if I'm going to hold my breath that the church will do that, as we are seeing the majority of the Christian mm-hmm. church here in America moving into homeschooling, which teaches a revisionist history. So the Tim and April show, they talk about where this Christian nationalist idea really took root and what the core issues were. It wasn't about abortion. It wasn't about any of that. It was about schooling and segregation and desegregation. Mm-hmm. And he mentions that the there's two core figures that are behind a lot of this push and this drive. It was RJ Rushdoony, and it was also Jerry Falwell. And it was in response to the desegregation within their universities and schools. And so they therefore pushed the idea to the average Christian household to move into homeschooling and to get out of public education, to, you know, basically, you know, take people out and try to ruin the public education system from within by removing all these people that they would need funding for and everything like that. And then, you know, teaching this revisionist history. So yeah, it's so important to do. And you mentioned Bonhoeffer, and I've been hearing this a lot recently, the figure Martin Niemöller, which is a very complicated person. Of course, he was in prison because he spoke out about the state control of churches, but he was very right-wing, anti-Semitic, Nazi supporter. So he is a very complicated character, but he did come out with a poem called First They Came. And so it says this: "First they came for the communists, and I did not speak up because I was not a communist. Then they came for the socialists, and I did not speak out because I was not a socialist. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I did not speak out because I was not a trade unionist. And then they came for the Jews, and I did not speak out because I am not a Jew. Then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak out for me." And it was so powerful, and it makes me think of what's happening now with the deportation of you know, immigrants, both legal, non-legal, and just people that are deporting for other reasons. And if we're not speaking out for them, if we're not putting our own selves on the line for them, you know, if this keeps going down the train, this could very well happen, like how Martin Niemöller puts it. And maybe that goes into immigration. We can start talking about the deportations and everything with that too. And I think there is Muhammad Khalil and a lot of people like that too.
Yeah, I have a lot of thoughts about that. I get accused a lot of time about, well, you just want open borders, and no, that's not actually accurate. I do think that we need to. Yeah, I'm not an immigration lawyer. I actually have friends that are here locally, and they have educated me on just how insane, complicated, lengthy, expensive the process is. That it is completely broken, that there are not enough lawyers or judges. Those that work in immigration law do not get paid very little. Most of the immigration work, according to the people that I know here in Florida, a lot of it is done pro bono. You know, they work other law, other cases, and then they donate their time. But I think, again, we all know, I think that most of us know this, that this push to rid our country of a specific group of people has nothing to do with immigration. It's not about upholding law and order. It's not about upholding anything other than white Christian nationalism. It is once again centering power around people that look like me but believe differently, right? I mean, it's those people, like you just said, Jerry Falwell. It's that group of people. This day, you know, you can turn on, was it, I don't even know if OANN, is that even still a thing anymore? Newsmax. I see stuff on Right Wing Watch all the time about people talking about this. There was a episode just the other day, and I cannot think of what it is because I obviously do not listen to it or watch it. But this woman was talking about, I did a reel on it because she was talking about the hardest person to be in the United States right now is a white male. And I was just like, are you freaking kidding me? What are you talking about? It just blew my mind. And it's this whole, I think it's all tied together, and the push to rid the country of Hispanic people, black and brown people. I think it's rooted in that idea. I mean, we've heard Trump say it, right? It poisoning the blood of the country. You know, I mean, that echoes back to, you know, the 20s and 30s Germany and the things that Nazi propagandists put out. So, I mean, it's not about the law.
No.
At all.
No.
And they don't care that a law is being broken. They care about who's breaking the law. Mm-hmm. That's what they care about.
Yeah. And I heard some statistics somewhere in the range of like 75% of the people that were sent to El Salvador recently were not actually, didn't actually have any violent criminal record. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I read that.
And speaking of, was it Muhammad Khalil that was sent there accidentally? Was it him or was it someone else?
I could look it up real fast, but
there's someone there who his name was really big in the news recently, but he sent there accidentally, and he was even admitted by the administration, by Trump's administration, that it was by accident, but they're not going to bring him back because he's already out of the country. And I heard it was someone saying that it's easier to take the person away from the law than the law away from the person. It's easier. Once you get them out of the country, away from, you know, U.S. law, due process, then it's easier to just say, just wipe your hands clean and say, well, I can't do anything. It's in their hands now. And they're, of course, not going to do anything about it. So what are we going to do? We're stuck in this limbo of, you know, we need justice, but we can't have justice because no one, everyone's saying their hands are tied and they can't do anything.
Yeah. So I did look it up. Kilmar Armando Abrego Garcia.
Ah, that's right.
Yeah.
There was a clip of Stephen Miller. It was kind of a comedy. It was like, you know, somebody put some comedy with it, but it was him saying, okay, what if we brought him home? Like, what do you think would happen? And then somebody jokingly say, well, he could be with his family.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, seriously. Well, and the thing is, like you said, you know, you brought it up. I, again, not a legal expert, but I wish somebody would explain it to me like I'm five, that, you know, they keep claiming that he's an MS-13 gang member, his family and others, you know, whoever were part of this, you know, even the authorities said, no, he's not. If there was only a way for us to discover if he actually is, oh, look, that's called due process. Just do the thing and there would be no argument. Like, but again, we all know that it's not about that. None of it is about that. It's about scapegoating. It's about, look, they're the problem. They're the ones stealing the jobs. They're the ones doing this. They're the ones doing that. And fundamentalism, much of evangelicalism, whatever other ism or ist you want to put to that, cannot exist without a common boogeyman. And we've got a few right now.
We've got a bunch of boogeymen.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know if you've read the book, A Church Called Tove. I like to quote a lot of things. So in the book, it says, a system or culture that perpetuates abuse will question the motives of those who ask questions, make the discussion of problems the problem, condemn those who condemn, silence those who break silence, and descend upon those who dissent. And I brought up Muhammad Khalil. I think he was the one that was arrested for speaking out against the atrocities happening in Palestine.
Yep, that's it.
He was the one for that. And he was arrested solely on that. And, you know, he's still in, you know, talks with his lawyers and everything, trying to get him released so he could be with his family. Mm-hmm. That was like the sole reason. And he's the one that's condemning, but they're condemning him for condemning. He's the one that's dissenting against the system, so they dissent against him. And it's this whole empire process of, you know, if you speak against us, we will take you down. And a lot of people have been bringing up with like the brown shirts in 1930s Germany, of them just saying like, you know what, I'm just doing my job. And you're starting to hear a lot of that with a lot of you know, authorities here in America. I think there was a video of in New Mexico, this woman was driving across into New Mexico or something, or maybe out. And there was an immigration border stop. And the lady was fighting back. She was a white woman, but she was fighting back. She was saying like, I've never had to stop for this. I drive this road all the time. Like, am I detained? Like, can I go? Am I under arrest? And they just kept saying like, you know, they just trying to hold her there. And finally they're like, yeah, you're detained. And she's like, for what? Like, I'm recording all this. I'm going to be calling my lawyer and suing you. And basically they're saying like, you know what, I'm just doing my job. like, you know, don't point fingers at me. I'm just doing what I was told to do. And, you know, we might start seeing a lot of that, a lot more of that in the coming years. I hope not. I hope that there's enough people that fight against the system and really put a halt to what's happening. But we are starting to see it, and we might start seeing it more. So I don't know.
Yeah, I think, you know, yes, I think we should. And I think that as for those of you, you know, your listeners that are, you know, I don't think you have to be a person of faith, but I think I still claim the title Christian, because I'll be damned if that MAGA version that's hijacked the name of Jesus gets to be the dominant expression of Christianity. But I do think that there is a special responsibility for people who claim to follow the person of Jesus, the way of Jesus, right? To, like, we're called to do that, if I can use that language. You know, we're called it is a responsibility of faith. Like, if, I know that so much of our faith has been hijacked and it's this personal thing, personal relationship, and it's individualistic and, you know, it's my relationship with Jesus. But if you look at the Gospels, man, it's communal. Like, liberation, salvation is communal. You know, if you look at, like, not to put my pastor hat on too much, but I use this all the time. When did salvation show up for Zacchaeus? When he made restitution and salvation came to everyone, right? Like, I'm not saved until we're all saved, if you want to use that Christian language. And so I think that we have a responsibility to speak truth to power. And I often get told, like, just stick to the gospel. And I'm like, bro, are you serious? Have you even read it before? Like, the fact that you're calling it gospel shows, is a testament to the fact that it spoke truth to power. To even call the gospel of something is about speaking truth to power. So, but speaking truth to power is part of our responsibility as being little Christs. Like, that's what got him hung up on a cross, was speaking truth to power. So if we're not willing to do that, then like, maybe. And I don't mean to, I don't want somebody to hear this and be like, well, I don't have the platform, or maybe I don't have the ability, or I don't have the aptitude to do that right now, 100%. Mm-hmm. But I think we can all do something, right? Like, I've been given, like, again, I don't play the games with social media, blah, blah, blah. It just showed up. It literally just showed up. I have zero interest in building platforms. None. I did that in my 20s. It was awful. It almost cost me my marriage and being at this, like, this mega church kind of thing. And I have zero interest in going back to it, but it showed up. So I'm going to use it, right? Like, and that's what I'm going to use it for. Not everybody has that or wants that at all, or even has the personality to do that. But we can all make phone calls, you know, download the Five Calls app. Mm-hmm. I encourage people to do that all the time. Make one call a day. What difference would it make if everybody made one call? So I think we do. I think if Jesus's way, if the way of Jesus, if that spirituality means anything on earth, I think it is, we've got to work towards fulfilling that prayer that he prayed, right? Bring heaven to earth. And I think part of that is, how do we structure our society? And if our society is structured in a way that it runs over the marginalized again and again and again, then I think it's part of our responsibility as Christ followers to try and dismantle that as lovingly as possible.
Definitely. So I was recently hearing that the most unique thing that came out of Jesus's mouth was to love your enemy. And in the 20th century, it took a Hindu to introduce it back into American Christianity, which was Gandhi. He was talking about Christianity, brought this whole concept back. And I think it was John Dominic that was saying, I think love your enemies has to be translated to nonviolent resistance. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you're not loving your enemy. And of course, when you look at nonviolent resistance, you got Martin Luther King. Actually, I got the book right here. Why We Can't Wait. Nonviolence is a powerful and just weapon. It is a weapon unique in history, which cuts without wounding and ennobles the man who wields it. It is a sword that heals, both a practical and a moral answer to the Negro's cry for justice. Nonviolent direction action proved that it could win victories without losing wars, and so became the triumphant tactic of the Negro Revolution of 1963. I mean, he's got numerous quotes about nonviolent resistance. Mm-hmm. I even quoted a couple in my Easter episode, but, you know, it's just one of those things. Like, we are in dire need of creative extremists to find new ways to be nonviolent about the resistance. And there's just something so powerful about that.
Yeah. And that's an excellent book. One of the things that really struck me about, and, you know, diving into Dr. King was, number one, what was super challenging to me was when he talked about I can't remember if it's in a letter from a Birmingham jail, and I think it might be, but where he talked about like the, one of the biggest hurdles is the white liberal, you know, kind of like just being like, just be patient, you know, like it's fine. Don't do this and do that. And what I realized is like, oh, that's me. Oh, that is so me, yeah. You know? And like, because, you know, honoring, I guess when it boils down to comfort over discomfort, you know, like, or maybe it's understanding comfort or peace as comfort, right? Like this is uncomfortable. So this isn't peace, where peace isn't the absence of, you know, conflict, right? It's the absence of those inequalities. And that was a hard realization for me to come to, and understanding, oh, no, my job is also to do this thing. And yes, it's going to disrupt. And yes, you're going to lose things over it. And yes, you're going to, you know, strain friendships. But again, I mean, if you want to bring it back around to that whole Christian aspect, isn't that what Jesus said would happen? Like if you live this out, and of course, that was hijacked. Where we came from, right? It was all twisted and turned around. But I think at the core of it, Dr. King and Christ and so many others, you know, were saying the same things like, no, I didn't come to bring peace. I came to bring a sword, but that sword is peace, right? But for those that confuse privilege with peace or comfort for peace, it's going to be felt as a sword. That was such a difficult realization.
Yeah, that verse you brought up, it's one of the most misconstrued verses, I feel like, in the Gospels, is the Jesus talking about coming with a sword, and it's often used as a justification to have an AR and to, you know, defend yourself with violence and all that, when really what you said is really what it is. I hardly get into the comments of social media, and I accidentally did because I was defending someone because somebody came in with a very anti-Semitic response. So I was trying to defend the original post as well as explaining like no. This, and then they brought in that Matthew, I forget what the verse or chapter verse is, but about the sword and Jesus saying, you know, I'm coming with a sword. And yeah, I've heard that numerous times, and yeah, it's kind of like, you know, in instructing people, educating people about what these verses actually are getting at versus how they're actually used and misconstrued in different situations. So yeah, let's keep educating. Let's keep instructing and keep showing, you know, the beautiful way of Jesus moving forward. So yeah.
Yeah. That's one of the things that we really focus on here locally is in the deconstruction work that we do with people is helping them reframe those things because they were so difficult. They're so difficult to see in different lights, in a different way, because what we were given was so foundational to everything, to the way that we see the world, to the way that we move in the world. And it's like rooted down in your lizard brain, right? And so when those things begin to move and shake, it feels like the world's falling apart. But helping people piece things back together without dictating what that looks like for somebody, but helping them understand, no, when Jesus says this, okay, it can be seen this way over here, right? Like, sure, it can be, and it can also be this, or it can also be this, you know. And then helping people understand, you know, like if we're going to follow this way of Jesus, just like you said, you know, some of these things that are misconstrued, they're just that. Like, no, I understand you think this way or we're taught this way, but does that actually fit with lived experience? Does that actually fit? One of the guiding principles we use is, does it produce good fruit? Mm-hmm. Because Jesus said, you can spot false teachers by their fruit. So if you can spot a false teacher, you can spot false doctrines, you can spot false anything, does it produce good fruit? And if it does, okay, well then let's wrestle with that. Mm-hmm. If it doesn't, if it categorically does not produce good fruit, then we can chop that tree down and we can leave it where it belongs, on the rubbish pile.
And wrestling with discomfort is the best way to put that. When, as I, you know, study in like Karl Barth, Bonhoeffer, Tillich, like all those you know, really big name theologians, it's really allowed me to ask difficult questions, think critically, and really wrestle with that discomfort, because it has challenged me in many ways. And it's just, yeah, it's a beautiful way to put that, wrestle with the discomfort.
Yeah, one of the things that we've been branching out into here is offering spaces for people to do that. Mm-hmm. Is to, whether it's like one-on-one or it's a small group of people, to have the space to ask really hard questions or uncomfortable questions, and then to be able to just sit in it for a minute. And, you know, maybe there's a clear answer, maybe there's not, but it's okay either way, right? And to come to differing conclusions. And that's okay too, to embrace that ambiguity and uncertainty. And that feels so hard and so uncomfortable, especially at first. You know, now I find great beauty, you know, and worth in those things. And yeah, and you know, bringing different perspectives to the table and how that enhances and enriches, you know, everybody else's. But man, that is difficult. It's hard to do alone. And when you're leaving those places, they're just not place. They're not other places waiting for you to give you that room, you know, which is why I think so many people end up doubling down. Like back to our earlier conversation where my friend, you know, with faced with like actual facts, well, he'll just retreat back into, well, I think and I feel, and it's groupthink, because it's easier, because he feels like there's probably nothing waiting for him, you know, even if he can't express that, that's tied to it. And so trying to give people that are ready a place to be able to wrestle with that, to sit with it, because it is so difficult, especially when everything is so tied to everything else. Like everything that we've talked about today is all tied to this stuff. Mm. And it's so complicated and so enmeshed in our lives that basically your entire belonging is tied to your worldview. And if your worldview falls apart, then so does your belonging. And that's really hard.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to hold you up too much longer here. I wonder if we could maybe transition into talking about these guys that we're wearing here. So I'm actually wearing one of the shirts that your spouse has a company, and she makes shirts. And I know you're wearing one in the video. And of course, my listeners won't be able to see them, but mine says, "I'm a red letter Christian, not a red hat Christian." And then maybe we can talk about your shirt as well.
Yeah. Yeah. She came up with this one too. It says, "Your theology is showing," but the O, one of the O's in theology is orange with blonde hair. So you can just a subtle jab.
Oh, I love it. And you guys have got several other shirts available too. Yeah. And what was the name of the company again?
It's called The Slippery Slope. Yeah. My wife, she put out a post the other day. She's not a very outspoken person. And I am. As a matter of fact, I think what's so funny is that if people come across me for the first time on like Instagram, which is the main platform, they will see a very measured Joe, like a very thoughtful response. And they probably think I'm like that all the time. My personality is very much a hammer. And so I'm very outspoken. I have very strong opinions, and I am not shy about having those discussions. I don't need not to convince anybody. Like I don't need others to see things the way I do. I just landed where I am. But anyway, so she is not that. So she put out a post the other day talking about how, you know, we've been in full-time ministry together for almost 24 years. And for probably almost 20 of those years, the churches that we were at, she had to play a particular role as the pastor's wife. And that entailed a lot of like being silent, you know, submitting. And when the church made the decisions it made, you just got to suck it up and do it. You know, we all had to participate into that somewhat, but I think it goes far deeper for women, for people of color, for all, you know, anybody that doesn't look like me. Mm-hmm. So when we stepped out of that several years ago, she had a hard time kind of reclaiming her voice. And honestly, when she really started finding it was during the Harris campaign, Harris Waltz, seeing somebody like you know, Kamala Harris on stage, you know, just exude the joy and the leadership that she did. Man, what a different world it would be. But anyway, I digress. I just got off in La La Land there for a second, just thinking, oh man, we wouldn't be having some of these conversations right now. But anyway, so she felt really empowered in that and was, for the first time, was like very vocal in her support. And, you know, of course, was absolutely crushed when the United States decided to elect a, you know, convicted sexual predator and all kinds of other things. You know, good buddy of Mark Epstein. We'll just leave it at that. Mm-hmm. Or not Mark Epstein, Jeffrey Epstein. And so she was trying to find a way to reclaim her voice. And, I can't remember how it started. But it was just a conversation one night, and we came up with that slogan. I'm a red letter Christian, not a red hat Christian. Mm-hmm. And from that conversation came this t-shirt store, and she's just churning out these slogans, and people from all over the country are buying them. And she feels really empowered that the things that she's creating are helping other people find voices, and they're showing up. Like, you know, we've shipped a few overseas, you know, so it's just like, for her, it is very much about empowerment and reclaiming things that she felt were taken from her for a long time.
Perfect. You also run a small podcast, like mine, but much, much more successful and longer running. It's called, and I'm going to have to slow this down, so I don't have to bleep myself. It's called Shift Happens.
Yes. Shift Happens. Yes, you do have to say it slow. Yeah. Yeah. It was born, I don't know, I think I've been doing it 3 or 4 years now. And it started here locally. It started again by a conversation. There is a church here in town. It's one of two churches that you could probably label mega churches. We might have three. They had a youth minister at the time that he and I just butted heads all the time. He put out just the worst trash theology on social media. And I would respond to him because I knew that there are kids listening to this. Like, you are poisoning these children, these students with this. And what I was finding is that it was a very solidified echo chamber. And so it was just like hitting your head against the wall. And so I was having a conversation with a good friend of mine. Her name is Tamara Perry Leonardo. And at the time, she was the Pride, our local Pride Center's board president. And we were talking about it, and she just said, well, why don't you just tell better stories? Like, why spend time, you know, hitting your head against the wall? Why don't you just start telling better stories? And so we just started. And it started with just that, with stories, just regular everyday people. And every now and then it was like somebody bigger telling theirs. And it was queer Christians or Christian or people that had grown up in the church, queer, and them wrestling with that. And like, where did they land? How did they deal with it? You know, and it was just telling those stories. And then with the election of the person who's in office now, we felt like we needed to switch gears a little bit, shift, if you will, and start talking about some broader topics just because we knew what was going to be coming down the road. And so now it's broader still. We still interject some of those stories. But yeah, we've been doing it for 3 or 4 years now. And it takes a while, just starting to get some sponsorships of doing it. But I think, just like you, you've got a passion for this. I think the more people talking about these kinds of things reach broader audiences. Like, people who listen to you will probably have never heard of me, right? So I think the more of us that are out there doing this, the better. But it's afforded me connections to people I wouldn't have talked to otherwise. Like, mm-hmm. I've gotten to talk to I don't even know how many people and been able to be part of their story and sharing their stories. And so for me, it is very much a sacred space to be able to engage with people in that way. So yeah, it's been really good, man. It's been really good.
Well, I'm happy for you, man. I'm happy that it's been, you know, fruitful and that you've been finding a lot of joy within what you're doing too.
Yeah, I do. Very much. Well,
like I said, thank you so much for coming out, Joe. It's a real pleasure talking to you. I really like this conversation. I can't wait to share it with everyone. And I hope that we can, you know, possibly do something like this again too.
Yeah, Mark, it was good. It was a lot of fun, man. I look forward to talking again.
that's it for today's episode of Grub and Grace. I truly hope you enjoyed our discussion. If you like the content that we produce, be sure to give us a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts. It would really help us out a lot. Also, be sure to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and X. Until next time, stay curious, keep an open mind, and celebrate the traditions that bring us all together.